The year is 1975, and we're in the northern industrial city of Manchester. Sheila has just arrived at Middleton Police Station to visit her boyfriend, Trevor. Trevor is due to make an appearance in court in the morning. The pair sit opposite one another, divided by the bars of the small cell. The couple's conversation is hushed, and police officers are keeping a close eye from the perimeters of the room. But there's no hint of anything untoward. Deftly, Trevor casually lifts up his top, just enough for Sheila to catch sight of something tucked into his waistband. It glints in the light. It looks like a nail file. As Sheila looks up and meets the gaze of her boyfriend, he opens his mouth slightly and runs his tongue over his teeth. Then he points to his waistband again. He seems to be telling Sheila something. He seems to be saying he's going to use the nail file to grind down his teeth. This bizarre scene might feel like it belongs in a work of fiction, or perhaps the beginnings of a Hollywood scene. And it is a story that defies belief. But in fact, the nail file tucked into Trevor's trousers and the results of it being used on the man's teeth will become the smoking gun that finally brings one of the UK's lesser-known serial killers to justice. My name is Romola Gary, and I'm an actress who's always been fascinated by how criminal cases are solved, the amazing processes that go on behind the scenes, and the clues that clinch the case.
My name is Tracy Alexander. I'm the head of the British Academy of Forensic Sciences. I've spent years finessing these processes, searching for those clues. I've dedicated my career to using science to help the course of justice, and my work has ensured that hundreds of criminals have gone to prison and that the wrongly convicted have gone free.
Together, we're going to lift the lid on some of the most extraordinary cases from around the world.
We'll discover how, with the help of science, everyday items have become the key to catching a killer.
From What's the Story Sounds, this is Smoking Gun. Episode 7. The Nail File. Trevor Hardy was no stranger to the inside of a prison cell. He'd been familiar with law and order since he was a young boy, growing up in semi-rural Moston, on the outskirts of Manchester. A troublemaker at school, Trevor spent an escalating amount of time in detention. Sometimes he was even shipped out for stints in special disciplinary schools. His family, his straight-laced father and hard-working mother, didn't know how to handle their increasingly wayward son. They were embarrassed at the amount of trouble Trevor attracted and preferred to brush his behaviour under the carpet or avoid confronting it altogether. Trevor's brother, Colin, too, was tarred with the same brush, something he later went on record as saying ruined his life. This was the 1960s, a vibrant time where, all over the UK, there was a newfound freedom. A world of free love and new opportunity. But freedom was the one thing Trevor found hard to keep hold of. Trevor was a true petty criminal. As soon as his age reached double figures, he'd countless incidents of burglary and breaking and entering to his name. His penchant was to steal cash rather than anything like jewels or ornaments. Even at such a tender age, he was savvy enough to avoid stealing items which could be identified by police. Back in the 60s, the suburbs of Manchester lived under the umbrella of community, with households leaving their doors unlocked because neighbours looked out for one another. But whenever Trevor was in the neighbourhood, and not in juvenile detention, doors were resolutely locked and bolted. Age 15, Trevor was put in prison for 12 months for a series of 20-plus burglaries across Moston. he was his very own crime wave and became the youngest inmate in the city's infamous Strangeways prison.
Despite his young age, Trevor was becoming a genuine danger to the public. And rather than putting him on the straight and narrow, his spells in prison only seemed to exacerbate his destructive and dangerous behaviours. By his early 20s, Trevor had been in and out of countless correctional institutions. He was actively avoided in the neighbourhood. People crossed the streets to avoid him. And he was barred from most local pubs and bars. When Trevor was about, trouble was always brewing. And despite his slight frame and short 5'7" stature, he leaned into violence at every occasion. In one incident, he stabbed a man in the leg after a row in the pub, almost severing the man's femoral artery. In another, Trevor hit a man on the head with a pickaxe for a disagreement over the bill. That man never worked again. Trevor was sent to prison for his outburst, sauntering out of the Isle of Wight's Albany jail on November the 18th, 1974, just 5 years later. There was absolutely no possibility that this stint inside had set Trevor straight. In fact, during his time inside, Trevor had whiled away the time brooding about the revenge he intended to get on two specific people. The first was his old pal, Stanley O'Brien, whom he suspected of double-crossing him to the police. And the second was 14-year-old Beverly Driver. Beverly had been a girlfriend, but while Hardy was in jail, she'd found a boy of her own age and started dating him. Trevor couldn't stand for that, and soon after he walked out of those prison gates, he went straight to Beverly's parents' house and threw an axe through their window. It made him feel good, but not good enough to assuage his anger. But as he walked home from the driver's house, he saw something that might.
Janet Leslie Stewart was 15, though she passed for much older. She lived in Harper Hay, Manchester, and she was tall and beautiful. Janet had been the Rose Queen at the Harper Hay Church, which she attended every week, and she worked at the local entertainment complex, the Belle View. On New Year's Eve 1974, Janet was on her way to a party with friends. But it was a party at which she never arrived. She seemingly vanished into thin air, and her frantic parents reported her missing. Unbeknown to everyone, Janet had bumped into the manic Trevor Hardy, who'd been walking the streets in the dark. While no one knows exactly what exchange took place, what police, forensic experts, and pathologists do know is that a knife was plunged into Leslie's neck, and she crumpled to the ground, where she soon bled to death on the cold pavement. She was later buried in a shallow grave some 3 miles away in Newton Heath, North Manchester, though it was a long time before anyone would learn Janet's fate. Trevor's crimes had tipped into the unthinkable. His appetites were no longer for petty cash or barroom brawl. What he now craved was much darker. At this point, Trevor was nearly 30 years old, and many of his peers and acquaintances were settling down, and to everyone's surprise, it looked too like Trevor might have found love of his own, in the form of a local woman, Sheila Farrow. After meeting in the pub one night, they immediately hit it off and quickly became lovers. Sheila was older than Trevor, but that didn't seem to stand in their way. The pair moved in together quickly, living in various flats across Moston. But the relationship, though outwardly steady, did not curb the appetite which had begun with Janet Leslie Stewart. And soon, Moston would have far more to worry about than just locking their doors.
It's July the 18th, 1975, and a man is walking down Lightbound Road past a building site. It was a complete eyesore, he thought to himself. Amid the rubble and piles of rock and stone, the man passively observed a sheet of discarded cardboard. And then he stopped. Protruding from beneath the cardboard, he saw two long, pale legs. Len Starkey was the first police officer on the scene. He quickly discovered that the legs belonged to a woman who was found lying on her back with her arms outstretched. She was semi-naked. Her face had been mutilated, smashed in repeatedly with a concrete slab. And even more horrifyingly, she had bite marks all over her torso. Her nipple had been bitten off. And beneath her thickly lashed lids, she was missing her eyes. The police soon ascertained that this young woman had not been sexually assaulted. The crime, it appeared, was a display of sheer violence. While Manchester is a big city, it didn't take long for the mystery victim to be identified. A report had come in of a woman who had vanished the previous evening, and detectives currently assumed the body under the cardboard and rubble would be her. The victim was 17-year-old Wanda Scala. She worked in the local pub, and after a game of pool at around midnight, she had left the pub and headed home. Assuming that Wanda had been attacked in the same place as her body had been discovered, she was only 400 yards from her home. Manchester police sprang to action. They cordoned off the scene as Wanda's body was recovered and taken to the mortuary. And in the meantime, a fingertip search was conducted for any clues as to the identity of Wanda's killer. There were no leads or witnesses to this horrifying murder, and a public appeal was made for anyone with information to come forward as word began to spread across the city via various news outlets and, of course, the grisly rumour mill. 2 days later, an officer revisiting the scene spotted a pair of shoes in a corner of the building site. Shoes that hadn't been there during the fingertip search. The officer examined them. They matched the description of those that Wanda had been wearing. It seemed that someone had put them back where Wanda's body had been found after the event. And it made sense that that someone knew about Wanda's murder, most likely the attacker themselves. Were they racked by guilt, or were they taunting the police? Meanwhile, Trevor was seen in the area as normal, walking, taunting, and drinking. And locals still feared and avoided him, but none of them connected him to the murder in their midst.
Colin Hardy was on an impromptu visit to his parents' home when he bumped into his elder brother Trevor. Colin usually avoided his brother at all costs. He was unpredictable and threatening, someone to stay well clear of, despite the fact he was family. But this evening, Trevor insisted the pair went for a drink together. They got the number 80 bus to Middleton and went to the Albion pub for a pint of beer. Colin didn't want to be there. He just needed to pick the right moment to leave, which wouldn't send Trevor into a rage. And Trevor was behaving more oddly than usual, which made things even harder. He kept bringing up the recent murder of a woman called Wanda. Again and again, he turned the conversation towards that topic, until eventually Colin asked why he was so interested. Chillingly, with no change in cadence, Trevor said, "Oh, I did it." And then casually sipped his beer. Colin felt sick, and he was scared. His brother was unpredictable at the best of times, but this was something else. Trevor demanded that Colin take him and his girlfriend Sheila back to Colin's house. He wanted to carry on drinking, and Colin didn't know how to decline. After all, it wasn't a request, but an instruction. As the night wore on and the alcohol continued to flow, predictably the evening ended in a fight. A fight which was sparked from nowhere, but one in which Trevor showed such rage that Colin ended up covered in blood and unconscious, lying at the foot of the stairs. Trevor was out of control. He needed to be stopped. So the next day, battered and bruised, Colin went to Manchester Police Station and reported what his brother had said about Wanda. Police, who recognised Colin and took in the state of him, were wary. But nevertheless, the information about Wanda's murder had to be taken at face value, so Trevor was arrested the very same day. He was taken to the station and questioned for hours. Here was a violent local offender, clearly he fit the bill, and he'd confessed to his brother to boot. But the police needed hard evidence to support what Colin was claiming, and nothing had been found at the scene of the crime which linked the murder to Trevor. This was the early days of forensic examination, so there was nothing like DNA matches to rely on. But there was that bite mark, which had left distinctive grooves and punctures on Wanda's body.
Forensic odontology is the handling, examination, and evaluation of dental evidence, which can be presented in the interest of justice or to identify a body. Forensic examiners had taken an impression of the bite mark on Wanda's breast, forming an impression of the teeth used to cause such an injury. They would be able to match the impression to any suspect, with individual bite marks and teeth formation almost as unique as fingerprints. But while this technique was something police could use to their advantage, it was also an area of forensics that Trevor Hardy was familiar with. He'd instructed his girlfriend, Sheila, to bring a nail file to the police station whilst he was being questioned. And, using that nail file, he'd gone to work, chiselling sections of tooth away from his mouth to change the shape and size of his bite. When officers came to take an impression of Trevor's mouth, well, it didn't match with the bite mark on Wanda's body. His mouth was full of stumpy, worn-down teeth, not the kind which had caused such damage to the victim. There was little doubt that the killer's mouth was not Trevor's, and that wasn't his only ticket out of jail. To Colin's dismay, it turned out that Hardy also had an alibi for the night of the murder, an alibi provided by his loyal girlfriend Sheila, who said Trevor was with her all night. So it appeared Trevor Hardy was innocent. He was back on the streets, and in all likelihood, back on the path to further offending.
The communities around Manchester were tense. The Yorkshire Ripper was still at large. No one felt safe. But ironically, it wasn't Trevor Hardy who people feared. In fact, at one point, Trevor became an unlikely local hero after he saved his neighbours from a house fire. He was even photographed in the Manchester Evening News and dubbed a lifesaver, the man who had risked his own safety to save others. Hardy was doing a good job to distance himself from the trouble he had already caused, but his self-control and good behaviour wouldn't last. In March 1976, 6 months after Wanda's death, Sharon Mossoff from Failsworth was on her way to a works party in nearby Bolton. Later, just after midnight, she stood at Manchester Central bus station, waiting for a late bus to take her home. But the following morning, when her parents opened her bedroom door to check on her, they discovered that her bed had not been slept in. Meanwhile, braced against the frosty air, a local dairy worker spotted something bobbing in the icy waters of the Rochdale Canal. As he got closer, he realised it was a body of a woman. And in the freezing temperatures of the night before, she was almost encased in ice. Just like Wanda, this girl had been stripped and mutilated, strangled with her own tights. Once again, she'd been bitten. The murder made the headlines before Sharon's family had even had time to report her missing. And as soon as they heard about the body of a young girl discovered in the canal, their blood ran cold. Ralph Mossoff, her father, immediately went to the waterside, which was just 200 yards from the family's home. He knew, instinctively, that the body that they'd found was that of his daughter. The forensic tests provided a puzzle for officers, though. It appeared that the killer had bitten the victim as part of the assault, but then returned and tried to cover up the bite marks. It was a puzzle that would soon begin to make sense.
Police had a grim realization, an identical MO. The locations around northeast Manchester, the age of the victims. They had a serial killer on their hands. And it wasn't long until local journalists came to the same conclusion and began reporting it in the press. But there was something which made officers uneasy. While it looked like the work of a serial killer, the bite marks on the bodies, well, they were different. Surely there couldn't be two killers at large. The undercurrent of panic felt by the city reached fever pitch. And over the next few weeks, 23,000 people were stopped and searched by police. Anyone who looked remotely suspicious. Anyone wandering around after dark. Neighbourhoods like Moston and Blackley were gripped by terror. Local women were reluctant to go out alone after nightfall. But still, Trevor Hardy carried on his business as usual. In a nightclub toilet in Manchester, 21-year-old Christian Campbell's feet slid on the dirty tiled floor as she battled to get her footage. She was being strangled, and she could feel blackness creeping in around the edges of her eyes. After a brief conversation at the bar, a man had followed her into the toilet cubicle when she went to the loo. He had hit her violently around the head and was now throttling her with his bare, rough hands. In the struggle, Christian had bitten through her own tongue, and she was sure her attacker was going to kill her. As she began to lose consciousness, two women walked into the bathrooms, chatting loudly. There was a split-second silence before they both began screaming at the horror that confronted them. Christian's attacker, startled, released his victim's neck. She crumpled to the floor, and he flew out of the bathroom door, ran across the bar, and into the night.
The attacker was soon identified by other people at the bar that night. It was, of course, Trevor Hardy. And, as the warrant was issued for his arrest, he officially became a man on the run. Police searched all Trevor's local haunts and hideouts, but he managed to evade them. Later he'd tell them he'd slept in quarries, in railway tunnels and along canal banks, avoiding anyone who might recognise him. Of course, one of the detective's first ports of call was Trevor's girlfriend, Sheila, and they became frequent visitors to her flat in Moston. But to their surprise, Sheila revealed that she'd ended her relationship with Trevor. She wanted nothing more to do with him. Not only that, but she also had a confession to make. The alibi she'd given her former lover for the night of Wanda's murder, it had been a lie. Confirming what they'd long since suspected but had not been able to prove, police were now on the hunt for Hardy as the number one suspect for the murders of Wanda Scala and Sharon Mossoff, as well as the attack on Christian Campbell. And, despite Sheila's protestations, police weren't convinced she had entirely cut ties with Hardy. Keeping her under close surveillance, officers followed Sheila one evening as she left her house. She travelled to a house in the Manchester suburb of Stockport. And, sure enough, concealed in that house was Trevor Hardy.
It's August 1976. Now in custody behind bars, Hardy confessed to the murders of Wanda and Sharon. But, in a dramatic twist of the tale, he also confessed to another crime, the murder of 15-year-old Janet Leslie Stewart, at this point only known to police as a missing person. Hardy told police that 21 months previously, he had stabbed Janet in the throat and buried her in a shallow grave in the derelict croft of Newton Heath, just a mile from her home. He offered to take them to the gravesite, despite his previous attempts to ensure it was never found. Hardy told police he had revisited Janet's body and her gravesite time and time again, up to 3 months after her murder. At various points, Hardy removed Janet's head, her hands, and her feet. He threw her head in the lake and buried her hands and feet in satellite graves around the main one. Detectives were getting a window into the world of their deranged killer, a man who thought nothing of treating his victims as if they were rubbish. But something he was forthcoming about was the details and circumstances of the other murders. Hardy told police Wanda Scala's murder had been accidental. He didn't originally intend to kill her. And then with Sharon, she had disturbed Hardy as he'd attempted to rob a hardware store. In a true unburdening, Hardy revealed that he'd removed the ring Janet wore on her finger and gave it to another girl as a love token. He had also kept Wanda's bloodstained clothes and her handbag as trophies. Trevor admitted that his fetish for biting both Sharon and Wanda was sexually motivated. But in Sharon's case, after he'd committed the crime and left the scene, he'd realised that the bites would link both attacks together. His newly filed teeth would match his victim, and there was no way he could change the shape of his own bite again. So, in the dead of night, Hardy had returned to the canal and dived into the murky sub-zero waters. Clutching a metal rivet, he had attempted to mutilate Sharon's body further, hoping pathologists would fail to identify the missing nipple underneath the trauma he inflicted to her chest. It was a truly horrifying revelation. Officers were aghast. But these confessions meant that they could finally remove this menace from the streets. For good.
Trevor Hardy appeared at Manchester Crown Court in August 1976. Despite his confession to police, just before the trial, Hardy had fired his attorney and changed his plea to manslaughter. Now he was claiming that mental illness had caused him to commit the crimes, insisting that he was insane and couldn't be held responsible for his actions. The 12-strong jury heard the minutiae of each case. They sat through days and days of evidence. And they heard all about how Hardy had smuggled a nail file into his cell during time inside for a petty crime. How he'd filed his teeth down to stubs, an agonising process, to avoid being connected with Wanda's murder. The prison guard who found and confiscated the file in the cell had no idea of the true nature of its use, but inadvertently, he discovered the smoking gun which connected Hardy's crimes together. Sheila testified she'd seen the nail file too, and recounted the moment where Trevor had pointed to it secreted in his waistband, and when he'd run his tongue over his teeth, which he'd later filed to stumps. The jury heard all the evidence, and it didn't take them long to come to a conclusion. Guilty on all three counts of murder, the notorious Trevor Hardy was sentenced to three life sentences. On the 23rd of February 2008, UK newspaper The Times revealed that Hardy was one of up to 50 prisoners in Britain who had been issued with a whole life tariff and were unlikely to ever be released. The whole life tariff was reaffirmed later that year by the High Court, confirming that this dangerous man will never again be allowed to roam the streets. Although in the end, Hardy's life sentence was irrelevant. The by then 67-year-old collapsed in his cell on the 23rd of September 2012, having suffered a heart attack. He died in hospital 2 days later. Sharon Mossoff's father, Ralph, told the Manchester Evening Post, "Me and my family think this is the best thing that has ever happened to us. It's like winning the lottery. We had a big party to celebrate his death. We feel as though a burden has been lifted from our shoulders, knowing that he cannot come out and do anything to anybody else. We knew he was inside, but you cannot forget something like that. What he did was cold-blooded murder. He was an animal." Trevor Hardy will go down in history as one of the most sadistic serial killers to have walked the streets of Britain, with the nail file alongside him in the history books as one of the most unlikely tools of crime evasion. Smoking Gun is a What's the Story original podcast series. It's narrated by me, Romola Gary,
and me, Tracy Alexander,
and supported by the British Academy of Forensic Sciences. Their work supports the international fight to improve forensic techniques, to share ideas, and develop the crime-solving scientific advances of the future. If you've enjoyed this episode, please give it a rating and review, and help spread the word. You can listen to a new episode of Smoking Gun every week, wherever you get your podcasts.